Show us some love, Frisco.
Live on stage at KQED in San Francisco, Death, Sex, and Money hosted a revival. Four interviews and a revival. With help from Dwayne Wiggins of Tony, 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 who led our house band. They started our show with the classic Tony, Tony, Tony song, Anniversary.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Miss Anna Sayre.
You all, look at where our band is. This is so exciting. This is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate. The show about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sayre. I'm so excited to be with you right now for four interviews and a revival. And we've already gotten started. Thank you very much. A revival can be a lot of things. It can be sort of like a little bud coming out right at the end of February, beginning of March, tentatively thinking it might open. It can be something that happens after you thought something was long dead, not coming back, and then with a jolt, it's revived and back. It can also be something that's like coming back from the past, something you thought you'd said goodbye to, that like a revival of a play that you're ready to study again, look closely at, see what resonates, or maybe like an anniversary, kind of go back. You're like, oh, I remember this. And we're having a revival together because we wanted to gather to celebrate this new phase of Death, Sex, and Money collectively to combine our energies. You've felt that already. And I'm so glad to get to do it here at KQED, this beautiful headquarters for public media in the heart of San Francisco's doom loop. Maybe you've heard San Francisco is a ruined city that's circling a doomy loop. We know that's not true. We also know it's not true that everyone who is here feels like they can thrive here. Not everyone here feels safe here. Like there's a long-term path to a safe and stable home for more of us, not fewer than us, in this part of the country. We feel that all over the country. And even though our mood is festive tonight, we can admit these kind of things at our revival. Because, you know, things might not be as bad as we fear, and they might not be as good as we wish for. And that's part of the reason for a revival, to acknowledge something that has been missing. And it's a time to gather our strength together and to recommit to putting our shoulders to the wheel. And so we're going to do that. And I don't know about you. I need this right now in this moment. And we're going to do it in the way that I know how, the Death, Sex, and Money way, which is to gather together and listen to each other's stories. Tonight, you're going to meet some people you've heard on the show before. I'm going to introduce you to some people who haven't been on the show before. But let's do this. Hear how it all went after the break. Our first guest is Vicki Larson, and she was on the show back in 2018. We did a series about dating, and for a whole summer, she sent us real-time updates about what it was like to date post-divorce in Marin County in her 60s. And she's a writer. She has since written a book that's coming out this summer about living apart together. It's called Latitude, How You Can Make a Live Apart Together Relationship Work. And I will have you know, when I talked to Vicki in anticipation of this conversation, she quoted Margaret Mead and told me about postmenopausal zest. So I thought that's a good place to start. Please welcome to the stage Vicki Larson. Vicki.
Anna.
It is wonderful to be here with you in person. I remember when we first talked about dating, you said one of the hazards of dating in your 60s was ending up the nurse or the perv.
Yes.
Have you all heard that before? I was not aware of that. It stuck with me. And it's been a few years since, and I want to talk with you, actually going back. Yeah. Right when you were, when you got divorced,
yeah,
you were living in Mill Valley.
Mm-hmm.
You had kids at home you were raising.
They were young.
You were living in a house that keeping on your own wasn't
hard.
Automatic.
It was hard.
And so what did you think your ideal for romance was going to be after going through that divorce and thinking about what you wanted next?
Well, you know, that's a question I never had asked myself before. I just followed that relationship script, which is, you know, you meet, you date, you fall in love, become a monogamous couple, you live together, you put a ring on it, you get kids, you get a house, somehow a minivan appears. And I never questioned that. I mean, that's what we know. And when I got divorced at midlife with two young children, it's the first time I asked myself, like, well, that script's not going to work anymore because I have the kids, the house, the career. What do I want? Do I want a man? Like, yeah. Do I want a husband? I don't know. I knew that I like romantic partners. My life is full of a lot of love. I have the love of my children and the love of my friends, but yeah, I do like a man around, not 24/7 maybe, but so living apart seemed to be a thing, but it wasn't something that came intuitively to me.
You had to come to it. And I'm wondering, yeah, if, so you had kids at home, they, yeah, grew up.
Yes.
And you got more privacy in your home. And I wonder if in dating and thinking about sharing your home again,
yeah,
is part of what's attractive about living apart and being in relationship, that you still get to hang on to some privacy.
Well, that is the one thing that I think, I can't speak for every woman, but I think a lot of women don't have a lot of space in romantic relationships if they're living with someone. I know that I didn't, but that could be just me. I never felt that I should or could. I had this vision in my head of what a wife should be and a mother should be, and there wasn't a lot of me time or self-care time. And then suddenly, you know, I was divorced with 50-50 custody, and so my kids with their dad for a week and me for a week, and when they were with me, I was full-on mom, but when they weren't with me, I was like, wow.
Best time.
I am obsessed. I was like, this is amazing. And I thought, you know, if I knew that I could do this, maybe I could stay married, you know? I mean, if we just had, like, lived separately. But it wasn't something that came to me immediately because it's not that normal. I mean, a lot of people don't do that necessarily.
And I want to, you know very well, like, living apart together means you have to have two households.
Yeah.
That costs a lot of money.
Well.
Because when I think, as a Bay Area resident,
yeah,
when I hear Mill Valley, I think.
I know. Please don't. I
not
know.
Everyone across the country, but I think fancy. And so it was interesting to me to hear, like, it was hard. You were hanging on with your fingernails sometimes to this household as you were raising kids.
Well, I had no right buying that house from my former husband. And I didn't want to. He had bought the house as a journalist when a journalist could buy a house in Mill Valley.
Imagine that was a long time ago.
A long time ago. And he didn't want the house. And I didn't want it either, Anna. Not really. But I just wanted my kids to finish their schooling in it. And I said, well, one of us should just live in it. And then after they graduate, we can sell it. And he said, no, I want to pull my money out now and buy something. So I took out one of those five-year interest-only loans where they, back in the days, where they don't look at your salary, because if they did, they would have laughed. I mean, I was making $18 an hour, okay? You can do the math. I couldn't afford the house, but I could on that plan. And it was tough. you know, it was really tough. I was bouncing checks all the time. I was on a first-name basis with the bank manager who would call me and go, "Hi, Vicky, have you looked at your bank account balance lately?" I'm like, "No." Yeah, it was hard. And I never really thought I was going to keep the house, you know, because I had no money to fix it. And it's 1945 built house, so, you know, something went wrong, and something's always going wrong with houses. But, you know, we talked about this. My parents died, and they left me a small inheritance. Now, would I rather my parents be alive? Yes. Would I rather my parents have used that so my dad didn't have to be in a nursing home? Yes. But this is what they did. And when we talk about generational wealth, this is what we're talking about. It saved my butt. And then I was able to put a roof on the house, and I was able to hold on to it.
And you had this period of real sort of tenuous stability in midlife.
Yes.
And you are now have a little bit more solid under you.
A little bit.
You're in a relationship that you're excited about.
It's new. It's nascent, so it's not. He might be listening somewhere out there.
Like, does it feel like, when I say the word revival, does that feel like now at 68 years old?
Not yet.
67
and a half.
67 and a half. At 67
no
and
need
a half.
To prematurely age me.
We're into it. We're into the 60s. Because you told me something that I'm looking forward to about intimacy in the 60s, that's like, does it feel like a revival period of your life, or does it feel like, kind of, how does that word sit with you?
It does, and I will tell you why. Because you hear the narratives about what it is to be a postmenopausal woman. Well, we're invisible, and we're undesirable, and we're asexual, and we're irrelevant, and why do we exist at all, taking up space and air? What is our purpose? And you hear that, and you do internalize that. So to actually find a relationship or get married, like Kamala Harris did at age 50 and Anne Lamont at 65 for the first time, when that happens, it's like a transgressive act. It's like going, oh, society, oh, you think I'm asexual? Oh, you think I'm undesirable? Yeah, watch me. And I think that's what a lot of middle-aged women start to feel. It's that postmenopausal zest. It's like, no matter what ageist, sexist narratives that society wants to throw on us, we're like, yeah, whatever, we're just going to go and live our best life. And it does feel like a revival, yeah.
Specifically, what I remember you telling me was post-65, intimacy has felt more exciting in ways that you didn't know could be possible.
That's true.
That's so exciting. It's something to look forward to.
It is. I think there was an AARP survey that, you know, like, we're
people. Love this. You yes. don't often hear AARP surveys cited in conversations about sex. Glad
this
we're doing
is true. This. And, like, people were saying, I think it was Singles in America. Anyway, got both of those in there. You know, the women were saying, yeah, age 66 was, like, the best year ever. And I will say the 60s are fun. You know, they're really fun.
Zest, if you will.
Postmenopausal zest.
Vicky Larson, thank you so much for joining us for this revival.
Thank you.
Her new book is called Latitudes, How You Can Make a Lived Apart Relationship Work. And she also has a book called The New I Do, Reshaping Marriage for Skeptics. Thank you for being here, Vicky.
Anna, okay.
We're going to get more Tony, more grooves coming up. But I want to do a little housekeeping first. In the spirit of our revival, some of us might have lost touch, Death, Sex, and Money, and you, while we've been transitioning into our new relationship with Slate. So I want everybody to pull out their phones right now. You have permission.
I want you to look at where you listen to podcasts. I want you to look and see if Death, Sex, and Money is on your list. If it's not, it's okay. You just go to that little search bar and set death, comma, sex, search, and hit subscribe like it's a little paddle, bringing it back to life, reviving it. Because we want to make sure it's in. We're back in your rotation in our new life at Slate. And I'm so glad to bring our next guest on, who was a very important person that I met at the very beginnings of Death, Sex, and Money. He's been a friend of the show for years and a friend in life now. W. Kamau Bell first came on the show in 2015. He had just moved home to the Bay Area after the end of his show, Totally Biased. He was figuring out what was next, and we called that episode W. Kamau Bell Wonders, How Much is Enough? And that was in 2015. 9 years later, I want to know if he's found out. So please welcome to the stage, W. Kamau Bell. Such a beautiful thing. Such a beautiful thing. Such a beautiful thing. Such a beautiful thing. Nice. That is such a beautiful thing.
That was great. Look at that. That's wonderful. I got to tell you, Dwayne Wiggins over there in the bus is great.
The great thing about show business is you kind of always kind of get to go to your own funeral a little bit. Like, I would imagine you'd say those things at my funeral.
I will. I'll say.
Is that a bummer to talk about me dying?
Yeah, I've got more to say. That's very, it's eulogy material to now. Yeah. Because since 2015, you started a show called United Shades of America that ran for 7 seasons. Yes. On CNN. It won 3 Emmys.
It won 5. I won 3.
Oh, excuse me. Excuse me. The team behind United Shades won 5.
Yes.
W. Kamau Bell won 3. W. Kamau Bell won another Emmy this year for a documentary about growing up mixed called 1000% Me. If you've not seen it, it's wonderful.
It's on United Flights. High achievement. It's on United Flights in the section under an hour documentaries. So.
And you made another documentary called We Need to Talk About Cosby. Mm-hmm. That won a Peabody Award.
The sound was so different for that one.
Yeah. And since 2015, you and your wife, Melissa, had a third child who's now 5.
Yes.
So I want to know, at this moment in your life, how much is enough?
I mean, if I had 0 children, I would be retired right now. Like, I think I'd be like, a Peabody and 3 Emmys. I'm just going to, like, work part-time at the farmer's market. And
I did it.
Kamau's got the best kale. But, you know, I got these 3 kids who like to eat every day. And they like to live indoors all the time. And so and I have my mom who's 86, so they're, like, my resting rate, and I say this all the time, is lazy, but I also understand that, like, I have to take care of my family, so I'm working hard so I can one day be lazy.
And I want to know about working hard in this moment, because it is a strange moment in entertainment.
Yes.
Like in podcasting.
Podcasts are also entertaining.
Yes, sometimes, yes. But Hollywood in particular is trying to figure out the sort of streaming economy. We're post-strikes. Does this feel for you like a moment where you're having to restart? Does it feel like a time of scarcity? What's the feeling?
Yeah, I mean, the industry is upside down and backwards, and it's not just me. It's everybody I talk to is like, isn't working as much as they thought they were going to work, or isn't, or the big thing is like the post 2020, there was this sort of rush for like, showbiz is like, we need more black people. And we're like, yay. We're like, well, just for a year or so, then we're going to go back to regular. And so
Go
back to regular. I was trying not to say white supremacy. But like, so showbiz went sort of like and then the strikes happened, which were great and needed to happen. But now showbiz is like, man, seems like we still made money even though nobody was working. Why don't we just not have people work for longer and still make money? And so the industry is run by the wrong people across the board. But, and what that does, and when you see someone like Ava DuVernay say she had to raise money for Origin, which feels like and Issa Rae talking about independent financing, and who the hell am I? You know, so for me, because I come from 2 things, stand-up comedy and black people, I sort of know, like, I can't sit around and wait for the jobs to come in. So you always know me as being somebody who has too many things going on. So I'm always, like, actively pursuing other things because I know that this showbiz thing is mostly vapor. And I had 7 incredible years on CNN, United States of America. That's Showbiz Hall of Fame, 7 seasons. But my kids can't eat off of, like, the stories of United States of America.
So when you are trying to figure out, okay, it's on me to restart, reset, what, at this point in your life, in your creative life, how are you going about that? I know you're doing a stand-up residency at Berkeley Rep here in the Bay Area.
Yes.
Called W. Kamau Bell Gets His Act Together.
I like literal titles.
Like, how are you doing that? How does it feel like you're, like, going back to square one in a way that's, like, exciting, or does it feel, oh, I thought I wasn't having to go back to square one?
I didn't think it definitely feels like the same feeling I had when we left New York, me and Melissa left New York, and I was like, huh, I don't know what this career is anymore. Is the same feeling I'm having now, like, I don't know what the rest of this career looks like. And the only way I know how to, like, sort of survive those moments is by sort of like, okay, what can I do on my own that I'm not hoping that showbiz calls me about? And I hadn't done stand-up in about 5 years because of third kid and COVID. And so I was like, do I still do stand-up comedy? And so the Berkeley Rep is really me going up for an hour every Saturday being like, do I still do stand-up comedy? And sometimes the audience is like, a little bit you do, but not totally. That you just did that moment, but this moment you're not doing stand-up comedy. So it's really like, and it's really like a gut check. And then it's also like, I'm always on the lookout. I'm sort of platform agnostic. I'm always on the lookout for things I like and entertaining things. So I'm always so like, constantly like, huh, I watch a lot of YouTube. Maybe I need a YouTube thing. Maybe I should call my friend Anna Sale and have her join me for a project that I may be working on or may not. We'll just see what happens.
It was pretty fun. I don't know if anything's going to come of it, but we did a fun thing.
I just was like, I called my friend Anna Sale because I know cool people. And I was like, will you come let me talk to you for 2 hours in a studio? In a studio.
And I was like, that is the one skill I have.
Yeah.
I will be there.
I was like, I know you're good at talking. I'm not going to tell you what it's about, but I know you're good at talking.
Well, what was interesting about that is the scheduling piece of it, because what I find interesting in this moment for you, when you were sort of launching your stand-up comedy, filmmaking, television-making career, it started, you had a lot of time to sort of figure out your voice, to go to open mics, to walk
to
around
sit.
The neighborhood. And now you've got, there's a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of busyness around a father of three.
Since I've been here, my 9-year-old has sent me a picture of her math homework asking for help.
Oh, did you respond?
Yeah, I said, I don't know what this is. I said, I will Google this and help you in the morning, is what I said. But I'm going to help.
So you're like, oh my gosh, I've got to be on stage at Berkeley Rep, what am I going to say? Like, what does it look like to be like, it is Kamau's creative time now? Like, how do you find
it? I'm really working through it because there would be me, my wife Melissa's back here. And so we really had to figure out, like, I was like, oh, I need all the time on Saturday from this time to this time to really get into my... And I would sit in my office and just be like, I am now preparing for stand-up comedy. And I'm like, what am I doing? And then I'm on my phone, like, playing Wordle. And I'm like, all right. So I'm really learning what the new process is. Last week, I'm like, I'm not doing any of that. I'm just going to go to the Berkeley Rep at 6 and sit down with... So I have my process is Sharpies and printer paper and just write some things down. And it was the best week I had, but I don't know if that's the new process or if it just worked that week. But really, and also Nato Green, a friend of mine, Nato Green, is opening for me. I need like another old man comedian with me to help me get through it. So yeah, it's like, but I really am like I know I like still doing stand-up comedy, but I know I can't expect to do it the way that I did it when I was in my 20s and 30s, because that's an impossible ask to place on my family.
And when you are like, I feel overwhelmed, I feel scared, I need to revive my creative spirit, like, what does that look like?
I have I don't know if it's diagnosed as obsessive, but I will like listen to the same song over and over again. I like find a song, and sometimes it's a song I've found in the past or a new song, and that'll be the song that is like, you need to listen to this 1,000 times. And it's like a way to sort of like reset my system and like recharge me up. Yeah.
So it's one song over and over again with headphones on?
Yeah, AirPods, but yes.
And do you lay down?
No, I will be like walking through the house, making breakfast. There's no time to lay down. making breakfast, doing whatever, helping with homework, putting the kid to bed, and like and the song will be. And then I'm at work and I'm type. It's just like it's a whole thing.
Oh, so it's hitting. And what's been on the playlist, Kamau?
This was a weird one. So I feel like I've told the story, but I'll get through it quickly. So when I was in high school, my music was introduced to me by my white Jewish friends, Rob and Jason and John. And they all had very sort of different tastes of music. John was the weirdo. His favorite artist was Billy Joel, which was weird for a teenager in the 90s and 80s. And so Billy Joel released a new song, and it's been, for anybody who knows, it's been like a long time since he wrote a new song. And I was excited for John. I don't talk to John that often, but I texted him, Billy Joel's got a new song, which is a weird thing for a black guy to text somebody in the history of music. I mean, maybe Dwayne sometimes has been excited about it. But like, so I texted him, and the song is like, weirdly, me and Billy Joel are now the same age, because the song was like, this is about me. Uh-huh. And so it's been a, yeah, it's that Billy Joel, so it's weirdly Billy Joel has been on my returning playlist.
Turn the Lights Back On?
It's called Turn the Lights Back On.
Oh, it speaks to my midlife soul.
Yeah, I sent it to you, and you were like, I'm laying down. She's only got two kids, she can lay down.
I'm not sure if the band is prepared to play Billy Joel's Turn the Lights Back On as your walk-off music, Kamau.
Okay.
But we can just say, do you all know this song? Yeah. Turn the lights back on.
Yeah, right? Nice. Look at that.
Yeah.
Look at that.
I listened a lot.
Yeah.
W. Kamau Bell, you've given us a song to return to meditate to. You have a new Substack called W. Kamau Bell Asks Who's With Me.
Yep. I like names.
And you're on the latest season. He's talking about figuring out things. He's also on broadcast television right now on ABC called What Would You Do?
Yes.
Latest season of What Would You Do?
Yes.
Being broadcast into televisions across America. W. Kamau Bell, thank you for being back.
Thank
on
you.
The show.
Thank
so
you.
Glad to see you.
Thank you.
Speaking of music, I want to introduce this band. So, Rose Crelly is on the violin. Hugh Johnson is on the drums. Vernon Hall is on the bass. Mike Dinkins on the keyboard. Frank Stickham's on vocals over there. And our band leader, if you can believe this, is Mr. Dwayne Wiggins, an R&B institution from Oakland, California. Come over and talk to me, Dwayne. Thank you so much for being here. I love that you have your guitar with you.
My shield right here. Has been.
Yeah, keeps you.
Down. Keeps me grounded.
You got it. Dwayne Wiggins, with your little brother, Raphael Sadiq, yes. Who has been on Death, Sex, and
Little Brother. I love how you say that. He's a little bigger than me, but...
Yes.
Yeah, but these days, especially.
You are grown compared to him. You're several years older than him.
Oof.
And your cousin. You're part of the legendary R&B group, Tony.
Yes. 36 years, 37 years in the game.
Okay. Your 1990 album.
Yes.
The Revival. Tell me how you made this album, which is now, it's just like canon. How did you think this album ought to be called The Revival?
Well, first of all, when you listen to the sounds on it, you know, the B3 and a lot of classic instruments, everything starts out with the guitar with us. But, you know, the name came from an intern back in the day. His name was Matt Jones, and he just happened to be there when we were mixing.
An intern.
An intern back in the day. I mean, you know, we pay attention to people who's in the room. And we really didn't have a name for the album, but when he was listening, he just said, damn, this sounds like a revival. He started hearing all the, you know, the gospel sounds and everything. Feels Good was one of those songs. And so me and Raphael looked at each other and like, that's what we're going to call this, The Revival.
The Revival.
That's how we came up with the name, really.
And that was in a studio right here in the Bay Area.
I should say that because he may look for some points now. He was like, look, what's my percentage, bro?
Well, and like, as somebody who's played this music, as you said, 37 years and you played music before 1990, like, what is that... What does revival music, like when you think about what it does for the spirit, for the body?
It picks you up. When you listen to Feels Good, it really, it's like shout music, you know what I mean? And what twisted it and made it, you know, ready for the dance floor is we had a DJ. That was our first time mixing ourselves with a band and a DJ, and then things started taking a turn for us in our music. Mind you, that was the first album that we produced. The first album that was done was produced by Foster and McElroy, our buddies from Oakland. And, you know, they're responsible for En Vogue and Club Nouveau and everything like that. So, yeah, that album was, it was a revival when you listen to it. There's a lot of sounds that we took from church, you know, like, I don't know what you come to do. These are, well, if you grew up in the Baptist church, you know what I'm talking about. But these are like shout songs. And so it's a revival. I mean, it makes you, it picks you up, the spirit, you know what I mean? It speaks very intense with the spirit.
And I want to know about what it was like to come up in Oakland when you did. You're born in the early 60s.
Yes.
There's music around.
Lots of it.
When you like stepped out of your house, like what did you hear? What was the music?
Sly Stone. I grew up in West Oakland, Lower Bottoms, right across the street from Defermery Park. But Sly Stone used to jam a lot across the street. You know, growing up in West Oakland, everybody was from the South. My mom's from Pine Bluff, Arkansas. My dad's from Texas. And so everybody was just like one big community. Everybody kind of like looked out for each other. And they had a lot of fruit trees and gardens and stuff. So we kind of ate healthy at the same time, you know. But it was a great experience for me growing up. You just learned how to look out for others around you.
Well, I picture you sort of like stepping into this river of music that's flowing in Oakland. And then you pick up the baton. You make R&B music. And then you've produced all these young musicians. You've worked with Alicia Keys. You've worked with a band that went on, you signed them. They went on to be known as Destiny's Child. Have you heard of them?
They went on to be, yeah. Yeah. Whoa, and that one blew my mind. I mean, so when I signed them, that was in 1995, and I had done a lot of major deals before then, but then signing a group that was under 18, it's different type of business. It's, you know, court approvals and all type of things. So I learned business. Yeah, so actually, they raised me. They taught me. And then from there, from Destiny's Child to working with Keisha Cole, who lived in the House of Music in West Oakland, my studio. And then that's where I ended up meeting Alicia Keys and producing her and the IRE. Strange enough, it was a lot of women. Isn't it crazy?
I want to just like sit on that a little bit, because like to be a man who has this track record of not only producing young women, but like, you know, young women who are coming up in the industry. Yeah. I have heard of snake oil salesmen, you know, music managers. And what, when you thought about like what you wanted to tell not only these young artists, but the families of these young artists, like, here's what we are going to do together. And here are the ways that we're going to work together. You're going to be protected. I'm going to learn from you. I'm going to listen to you. Like, what was that conversation?
Well, it was really strange with Matthew Knowles, the father, who gave me the call to about Destiny's Child. And they weren't called Destiny's Child then. They were called A Girl's Time or something. And they're like 9, 10 years old, whatever. I met him again. They were 13, and he sent me a cassette. And I played it, and I called him. I was like, hey, man, I'm not crazy. This is not no 13 and 14-year-old kids. And he sent me a VHS, and I put it in. I was like, I was blown away. But I also knew that, you know, they got to learn the business. You got to learn the business of the industry. And so I've been very passionate about, you know, keeping, preserving the culture and respecting this industry. And so whatever artists I work with, it wasn't just about being able to show them how to sing or play guitar, this and the other. It was about showing them the game, how it works, how you have to be accountable. It's like, you know, I had to hire tutors and everything for Destiny's Child, you know, in order to sign and even to or in order to deal with them. So I learned how to do homeschooling in 95, 96. Mm-hmm. And so I applied that game to my kids.
And when you like are learning, like the game is also changing all the time.
Yes,
like,
yes it is.
When you told me you met Rose, you first saw Rose play during a Warriors game, right?
Yeah, she was
during
playing
a break in a Warriors game. And I love that you're like, who's that? I want to play with her. Like, I love that you're always looking out for artists that you can, like, bring in.
It's very reciprocal, believe it.
It's so cool.
The next generation, they got the information. All you have to do is expose them and, you know, get them some. I think it's very important to get out of the country and see how it works around the world. That's one thing. I started a nonprofit after, you know, working with Zendaya and then developing and working with the girl Her from the age of 10. So she was like 16 years old, and then working with Kehlani.
Just saw her at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, you see that? You see her grab that guitar? You see what I'm saying? It's a shield. It's definitely, This has been my savior. This has been what kept me focused through all of the trials and tribulations of coming up and growing up in Oakland. It kept me distracted from all of the bull. Believe it.
Well, so just going back to the game is different in 2024 as an artist who's trying to figure out how to get to make their art.
Yes.
And share it and get it listened to and support themselves while they're doing it.
It's got
to
be a passion.
And like with a young artist now, when you're like, we're going to work together, I'm going to teach you about the business. Yeah. How do you tell them, like, speaking of revival, like it's a different game. Like, how do you tell them how to do it?
Well, you take it to the people. It's about going to the people. There, a lot of people talk about the Tonys and how we've been here so long. And they'll look on our social media thing like, man, your numbers are low. This, that, and other. And they'll say, so you guys got to get your numbers up. I was like, hey, man, I don't know anything about that. All I know is we pack houses and we've been doing it for years and we get paid. So, what I know is... Yeah, that's my social media. I'm following the followers. You take it
Instagram
to the
Instagram doesn't know everything.
No, I mean Instagram. I mean all of those. You can have 2 million followers, and I learned that with Zendaya. I used to watch her. She had 4 million followers and stuff. And then we do certain shows, and things didn't go right. I was like, where are these 4 million people?
Yeah.
So I was learning. You know, you really have to take it to the people. You know, I follow the Frankie Beverly theory. You know, I've watched him consistently come to Oakland Paramount Theater. Out for years and years and years, and then he just became family. So when we go on the road, there's no more fans; they're family with us now.
Well, when you were on tour with Tony last fall,
yes,
Rafael Saadiq was with you.
Yep,
and
it's been 25, 26 years since we've been together.
Yes, it was a big deal.
So my kids have never seen us together. I was like, because my youngest is like 25.
That must have been so cool.
Oh, they tripped out to see us together. They were like, "Oh, Dad, taking your shirt off?" Really? Hey, like, you getting sexy with it? You don't do that at home. So yeah, that was a trip.
I'm curious. Like speaking of like some things, you know, we evolve, we change. Some things stay the same. And when it comes to family dynamics, like in the green room, you and your brother, like, what's it like at this stage of your life working together, performing together? Does it feel like it felt when you were kids, or does it feel like? I don't know. Yeah,
it's different with us. I mean, we can rehearse. He knows I don't like to rehearse. I live this life. You rehearse. You get things that I live this. You can't. This is what I do.
I bet that might annoy him a little bit.
It does a little bit, but he knows we look at the stage different. It's like a football field. It's like a basketball court. You know, we understand it. So when I'm on stage, it's certain things that we know that we grew up with, only me and him know. I don't even have to see him. He could say something on the mic or do something on the guitar, and I know exactly where he's going. He'll look at me, and I look at him, and we're passing the ball. It's different. Everybody else on the stage doesn't know that, but me and him know that. Yeah. And it was a beautiful feeling, looking over to my shoulder and seeing my brother. It's like, wow. That was the greatest feeling. I haven't felt so good. I haven't felt like that in so many years, and like I was so comfortable. But he controlled everything. He ran it, you know. He ran that like a pro, and I was very proud of him. You know, that's my little brother, Terrence. I can say this.
You can. We're a podcast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're a podcast. See, I have to get used to this. I was like, okay. I love your title.
Terrence, shut up. You were saying.
How did you come up with this title, though?
Sex, you got to play
money.
The game, right?
You got to play the game.
Dwayne Wiggins, I'm so glad you are here. I'm so glad you brought all these talented musicians with you, including another young musician.
Oh, yes. Young man I met on the Just Me and You tour. His name is Nasinga. His mom is from Memphis. His dad is from Jamaica. And he's Hare Krishna, Glenn Faith, and his whole style is crazy. But it's blues and it's country. And so we've been sporting these 10 gallons for years. Not just because of Beyonce, just...
I know, you were first.
we've been rocking him, boy. So I'm just saying, I'm so honored to have him out with us right now because he's definitely going to uphold the tradition of blues. It's that new blues, brand new blues. You guys get a chance to peep him out for the first time on your show.
On my show.
This is no bull. This is a 100%
I know, truth. And you said, can I bring this young artist who I'm producing?
And you allowed me.
I'm so glad. And how old a man is he?
He's 30 years old. Yes,
And he's recently arrived to Oakland, right?
Yes. He's been in Oakland, stuck in Oakland.
Okay, we're going to hear a song from Narsinghe. Please welcome Narsinghe for the first time.
You have an arm, I think?
You can play with my heart. You can play with my mind.
Yeah, you love playing games, but I don't play about my chains. So don't play with my money. Don't play with my money. Said, don't play with my money. And we'll be okay. Said, you can go through my phone. You can meet all my partners. You can come to all of my shows. Even meet my mama. You can go through my pockets, but don't go near my wallet. Oh, so don't play with my money. Don't play with my money.
Singer.
Thank you, Narsinga. Hey, that is spelled N-R-S-E-N-G-H-A. Write it down, because it's not on Spotify yet. You saw it here first, so hang on to his name. Keep looking up. Thank you for being here. We will not play with your money. We will get you more money, we hope. Thank you very much. Coming up, a conversation you won't want to miss. I talk with Dr. Bonnie Chen about whether the idea of revival makes any sense at all when you're dealing with grief. I want to tell you about our next guest, who you have heard on the show before. Her name is Bonnie Chen, and at work at Kaiser here in the Bay Area, she works as a palliative care doctor. She helps people deal with end of life, look at it, think about it. She accompanies them through it. And she was on our show talking about that work and also about her own experience of profound grief after the sudden loss of her son Benji in 2022. And I wanted to invite Bonnie to be with us tonight to talk about what life's been like since we talked on the show, about living with grief, and also about the other feelings that you notice more acutely when they break through. So please welcome Dr. Bonnie Chen to our stage. Thank you for being here, Bonnie.
Thanks for having me.
When we talked ahead of this revival, one of the things you told me about was noticing the first time you felt the sensation of what you called positive anticipation after losing Benji.
Yeah.
What was going on when you felt that, and what did it feel like to feel that again?
So I would say, like, the first part of grief is just so consuming, and it's despair and sadness, and you just can't, like, imagine what joy or happiness would feel like. And I think it was, like, maybe 6 months after Benji died, I was scrolling through Facebook, as you do, and this ad popped up, and it said, American Idol reunion tour. So when I was a first year medical student, we would gather every Tuesday, all with our phones, and we were either Team Clay or Team Ruben.
Oh, that was a good season.
And so this was Clay and Ruben together again after 20 years. And it was the first moment I felt the sense of, like, oh, I want to go to that. Oh, that's weird. And so I immediately texted my two friends, shout out to Jolie if you're here. And said, will you please go to this with me? And a couple of months later, we got on a plane to Durham.
You went on a plane to go to the American Idol reunion tour.
Yes, we did.
I love that so much, because it sounds like it struck you as a surprise that you could feel that.
Yeah. I think one thing that's really struck me about grief and my new way of being is that I follow spontaneous leads more, and that was maybe the first distinct one, because normally I'm so measured and, like, will this work with our schedule? And this was like, oh, I want to go see Clay and Ruben, and don't let the sun go down on me, and, you know, all of that. So, yeah.
I'm so glad you went and didn't talk yourself out of it. The other thing you told me about was something you're doing now, mm-hmm. In anticipation. It's Benji's birthday this week. Mm-hmm. People love you. They want to figure out how to support you. Often when people love people in grief, they don't know what to do. What did you ask them to do for you?
So Rich, my husband, and I were thinking about Benji turning 3, and how, I mean, honestly, it's just a really hard milestone. And I had this idea that it would be really meaningful to me to see his name written by the people who love us. It's just like now when people in conversation bring up Benji spontaneously, it's like a little balm to my heart to just hear it. And I felt the same way about, like, seeing his name in all these different handwritings. And so I think we sent an email a couple weeks ago just asking for that. And, like, even already, like, receiving these cards, seeing his name, seeing the memories people write about, has just been such an incredible experience every day, to just know, like, people make art, they write poems, they share a story. And I think receiving that feels like a way I've been held and can feel more solid in myself, even as we approach what feels like an impossibility.
That's beautiful. And how wise to know that you could give people an instruction that was so clear, that they could do to demonstrate their love and their care of Benji. When we talked on the show, I asked you if you ever talked to Benji, and you said, we don't have that kind of relationship yet. What's it like now? What's your relationship like now?
You know, I have felt in recent months a really distinct sense of him.
And even when I sent the email asking people to send us cards, one of the things I suggested they could write is, Benji is with you. And I was even thinking back there as I was like starting to get nerves sitting in the back watching like actual entertainers talk. What am I doing here? And there's this way I can hone in on a phrase like that, that Benji is with me, and just center. And Benji was a very confident, loud, screaming child, always demanding to make his presence known, which is actually quite unpleasant as a parent. but I think in that incorporation of his spirit into me, I find, there's just a way I can gather a confidence and a calm. And being someone who, like, before this has generally walked through life very tentatively, like, am I okay? Like, every sentence sort of ending with a question mark. There's a way in which, I don't know, I just feel him more, and I can feel more declarative in who I am, knowing that he's there.
I love picturing having a declarative, demanding toddler inside of you. Telling you to speak up for what you need, and he is with you.
I feel like that's going to change how when friends talk to me, they're like, oh, is that Benji right there?
So Benji's birthday is this week. Your birthday is later in March. as you thought about your own, the milestone of your own life continuing on, how did you think about how you wanted to mark that this year?
So I haven't had a birthday party for, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years. And I think around January, I just kept having this thought, like, I want to have a birthday party. But then I also didn't want to plan a birthday party. It just kept coming to me, and I was like, oh, I don't know, it's too much. And finally, I just emailed like 10 of my friends a couple weeks ago and said, I just want to have a party. I don't have a plan, except I've ordered a $150 cake. So please come to my house. Rich and Sam will be there, and we'll eat cake and be together. And it's like I was mentioning before, like, there's this like spontaneity now when I feel a sense of life and joy. You just kind of follow it, and yeah, overall, it's taken me to good places.
And this birthday party, you said Rich and Sam won't be there. You're sending your husband and your older son off for this birthday party.
They're not invited.
I'm picturing a lot of boas, maybe a crown on your head. This is going to be a fantastic birthday party. Thank you for sharing that image with us. And Bonnie, thank you for being here and talking with us about Benji and about grief in front of a crowd. That's hard, I imagine, or unusual feeling. Mm-hmm. And I want to just ask you, like, when I had this, I thought, oh, I want to talk to Bonnie, but it's called a revival. And like, how will that word sound to her? And when you think of that kind of concept of sort of rebirth or resetting, or kind of, there's almost like this idea of shedding something that was before and starting again. How has that sat with you, this idea of like revival, of something coming to life after grief? Has that always felt like a welcome way to think about what grief looks like?
I mean, I have to be honest, like when I first saw that word, the feeling that came to mind was what I've experienced for most of this grief process, which is like, I don't know, the idea of revival felt almost offensive because it's like the depth of this despair is so much. Like, how, I don't even understand that idea of what it looks like to come back to life or find a way forward. And then when I think back on the last couple of months, that has really softened to a certain degree, because as I think about what that time lingering in the despair has done to me, to our family, I mean, it's cut, right? It's carved all of us. It's hollowed us out in a way that I didn't know how to live with. And then in a pause or in a moment where you have these like spontaneous like glimmers, you grab onto them and you realize that that space, that hollowing that was created actually can like give birth to something that's different that wouldn't have been there otherwise. Would you ask for that? No, it's like, it's the most painful thing I could ever have imagined. And I don't know yet, but I at least don't take offense to the word revival now. Yeah.
Bonnie, thank you for being here. Happy birthday to Benji, and happy birthday to you. We're so glad you came tonight.
Thank you so much.
So this has been a revival. This idea that you can feel loss and grief about what is gone forever, and also wonder about what, being intrigued about what could be beginning. This is like a complicated emotional concept, landscape that is often not captured well on greeting cards, unless the greeting card is drawn by the artist Carissa Potter. She's one of my very favorite artists, and I asked her to be a part of ending this revival with us. Please welcome to the stage Carissa Potter. Carissa Potter is an artist from Oakland. You may know her work from People I've Loved. She's on Instagram. She has this shop of incredible art that she makes with her team. She also hosts a podcast called Bad at Keeping Secrets, which I like that name of that podcast. And I invited her to lead us in the last steps of our revival tonight because of what she captures in her work. I want to show you a little bit of what is so striking about what Carissa does. She does these like one panel illustrations. This is a person standing on their head or their hands, doing a handstand. You don't have to understand. It says, I'm just taking care of myself. Let's look at another one. A person laying flat in a sort of glimmering puddle, and above it, it says, whatever it is that keeps us going through hard times is slowly draining from my body. Let's look at another one. I feel loved when your actions match your words. So basic and beautiful. And I'm always like, whenever I see it, it makes me pause and think like, how did she capture that? Because it's kind of sometimes hard feelings, sad feelings. It doesn't run away from what's tough. But somehow self-compassion is always at the center of your work. You shrug. And you've been doing this kind of body of work since 2010. Where did this practice come from?
I think it was this like real longing to connect with other people. And so I would make these sort of objects to say what I really wanted to say. And then it turned into this process where I could choreograph or have these performance art pieces with other people. I make greeting cards. And I at the time I was really curious, like, what would it actually say if you actually put what you meant on a card? I can think of the first example I gave to my boss at the time, who I was really excited about and infatuated with, this card about, like, I like you, so now what? And here were all of these possibilities, and it didn't go well. But it was, but I felt like I needed to say it, and then it had been said, and there was a certain, like, relief, and relief is one of my favorite things to feel. I didn't realize the first drawing was about my mother-in-law until this moment.
The handstand?
Yeah. Living with her during the pandemic. I don't do handstands, but, like, just doing weird things around, like, your weird sort of quirky things that you do to take care of yourself. But then when you have different people living with you and they're like, why are you doing that? And you have to, like, come up with some answer when there's none.
This is just what I do to take care of myself.
Yes.
And when I spoke with you about joining this revival, you immediately sort of brought up the idea of, like, renewal, vow renewal ceremonies. And you told me you have long asked your husband to do a vow renewal ceremony, and he doesn't want to. Why? What appeals to you about a vow renewal ceremony?
Well, first of all, he doesn't want to because he did it once, and that was enough. And I really want to, when we said yes, or when we got married the first time, which was like 12 years ago, I didn't know what I was getting into. Like, I don't think anyone really knows what they're getting into when they make that sort of commitment or, like, have a kid or, I mean, do anything actually in life. If you knew what it actually entailed, maybe you'd think twice. But now that we've been together for a while and we know how hard it is, I think saying yes again to the, like, complicated nature of choosing to live a life with someone with our aging bodies and our health issues and our economic issues, I think, is a different thing. I also just really love public displays of affection. And I think it'd be really cool if he just, like, announced to everybody that he loves me. Or, like, I get, like, a little thrill if he'll hold my hand in, like, a movie. We went to our first movie recently since the pandemic, and it was like, felt good. Sorry.
So what we're going to do this evening, we don't need our spouses to do a recommitment ceremony. We are owning that we can be in charge of our own revivals. And I asked Carissa to lead us into our own vow renewal ceremony around the idea of revival.
I just want to preface this with, I spend a lot of time trying to control other people. Like, to maybe, like, leave subtle hints that, like, maybe the dishes could be done or you could do certain things differently. And I'm a 40-year-old person learning that I can't control anyone else. I can only control myself, and even that, it's kind of debatable. So instead of having this vow ceremony with someone else where you can't really hold, I mean, it's, again, you can't really hold other people accountable in the same way you can hold yourself accountable. Everyone I know in my life is having a hard time right now, I think. And I wrote this series of phrases to help us all commit to keeping going, because I think we're in a really complicated time. We've gathered here today to celebrate and redefine renewal. This is a commitment ceremony, and if you want to do it, and if it feels good, we're going to commit to ourselves together. Today, we're committing to holding on when the adrenaline fades and you're tired and things just feel hard. So let's begin by closing your eyes, and we're going to take a long, deep breath together. We're going to inhale and hold and exhale. May we remember that we can choose the stories that we tell ourselves. We can change the outdated narratives that no longer serve us. May we honor our resilience, that we have been through a lot and we're still here in whatever state we're in. And that is something to be celebrated. May there be things to look forward to for all of us. We're committed to finding joy and seeking pleasure, for action is impossible without hope. May we be open. May we know when there is actual danger and when our stress responses are just outdated signals. May we be grateful for what is, with the knowledge that nothing is certain and everything is in transition. This one's a big one for me. May we have faith that we did the best we could with the information we had at the time. May we assume good intentions of ourselves and others. May we commit to taking responsibility for the things we have done. We can do bad things and still be worthy of love. May we take comfort in the fact that we are alive, the insanity that out of all the moments that have ever been, that we are here together tonight is mind-boggling and just weird. With this, we have a certain awe and obligation. We commit to keep going. We don't know what the future will be or how we will feel, but we owe it to that person, our future selves, and each other to find out. Thank you.
Thank you, Carissa Potter. And I will remind you all that this is recorded, so you can go back and listen to what Carissa just said as frequently as needed. I'm Anna Sale. This is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. And again, don't forget, you could play this again as frequently as needed.
Play this record as frequently as possible. Then, as it becomes easier for you, play the record once a day.
Because it feels good. And then I, Dwayne Wiggins, and our house band and our sold-out crowd in San Francisco all danced to Feels Good by Tony, Tony, Tony. That was four interviews and a revival. Thank you to our five guests, Carissa Potter, Bonnie Chen, W. Kamau Bell, Vicki Larson, and Dwayne Wiggins. Learn more about each of them in our show notes. And for an upcoming episode, we want to know if you are considering a big reset or are already in the middle of one and need some advice about some part of it. What are your questions about resetting? Are you trying to figure out the timing on when to make a jump? Are you starting something new or restarting something old? What challenges are you facing in that adjustment? We'll try to help. Send a voice memo and tell us your name, a bit about your reset, and what you need advice about. And send it to us at deathsexmoney@slate.com, and we may use it in an upcoming episode. Death, Sex, and Money is now produced by Slate, where our team includes Andrew Dunn, Zoe Azoulay, and Cameron Drews. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer at Slate, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's head of audio. I want to say a big thank you to everyone at KQED who co-produced this show with us, especially Ryan Davis, the leader of KQED Live, who was a great partner with us. Our theme music is by the Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis. And if you're new to our show, welcome. We're so glad you're here. You can find us and follow us on Instagram at Death Sex Money. And you can find my newsletter at annasale.substack.com. You can also reach out to us anytime over email with voice memos, pep talks, questions, critiques. Our address is deathsexmoney@slate.com. We love hearing from you. I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate.
Give it up, give it up. We love y'all.